Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 37 for March 15th, 2010, The Voyage of Darwin's Beagle. Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, K-I-K-I. And with that, we will get started with this week's episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Episode 37, Voyage of Darwin's Beagle. We are talking today about science, evolution, genetics, and building a ship, or hoping to build a ship that will take science around the world and at least to the Galapagos, hopefully at some point, to do scientific research in the name of Darwin, follow his path. And we are talking today with Dr. Karen James. She is a biologist. She is a geneticist who works at the Natural History Museum in London. She also is the director of science for the Beagle Project, which we will find out more about in just one moment. But as you get ready for the show, as you sit back and you relax and you get ready to engage your brain for an hour of science, I want to start off with this letter from Charles Darwin to his sister, it was his sister, Caroline, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of timely. It's very timely, in fact, if you just think to the recent earthquake in Chile. My dear Caroline, we are now on our road from Concepcion. The papers will have told you about the great earthquake of the 20th of February. I suppose it certainly is the worst ever experienced in Chile. It is no use attempting to describe the ruins. It is the most awful spectacle I ever beheld. The town of Concepcion is now nothing more than piles and lines of bricks and tiles and timbers. It is absolutely true that there is not one house left habitable. Some little hovels built of sticks and reeds in the outskirts of the town have not been shaken down, and these are now hired by the richest people. The force of the shock must have been immense. The ground is traversed by rents. The solid rocks are shivered. Solid buttresses 6 to 10 feet thick are broken into fragments like so much biscuit. How fortunate it happened at the time of day when many are out of their houses and all active. If the town had been overthrown in the night, very few would have escaped to tell the tale. We were at Valdivia at the time. The shock there was considered very violent, but did no damage owing to the houses being built of wood. I'm very glad we happened to call at Concepcion so shortly afterwards. It is one of the three most interesting spectacles I have beheld since leaving England. A Fuegian savage, tropical vegetation, and the ruins of Concepcion. It is indeed most wonderful to witness such desolation produced in 3 minutes' time. Charles Darwin to his sister Caroline, 10 to 13 March, 1835. So, Karen, welcome to the show, and I just would like to hear if you have any thoughts about this letter from Darwin to his sister.
I guess my first thought, first of all, I'm delighted to be here on the show, so thanks for that.
You're welcome.
My first thought on hearing that read to me again, I haven't actually read that in a while. It was another Beagle blogger who posted that. And my first thought was that he didn't mean wonderful to see the city in ruins. If you know Darwin's writing at all, you know that he means awesome or powerful. He sometimes says wonderful to mean that. And he was really struck by the devastation there, as he writes in other passages of his journal. So the first things first is, that sounds a little bit bad taken out of context, but he didn't mean it like that. and the second thing is, I think that this recent earthquake did happen at night. the devastation that he saw has sadly occurred again. So it's a reprise, a terrible reprise after 150 years have gone by.
Yeah, it's amazing though to be able to look back historically and be able to have a letter from somebody who saw such devastation, you know, just a bit over, you know, 200 years ago. But it's just amazing.
Yeah, and actually it was one, he wasn't making light of the fact that it was one of the most important things that he saw. He was so shocked by how rapidly the Earth's crust could move and change, and for example, bring intertidal organisms up above sea level, and they were left there hanging and dying after the earthquake. So it really brought to his attention that these long spans of time that he imagined geological change taking place over were indeed possible. The changes that the grand structures that we can see in nature could have actually been achieved over a long period of time.
Or even shorter periods of time than what you might think, that maybe a giant earthquake could change the landscape so dramatically that dramatic changes would therefore have to happen to the animals, organisms that live there.
Right.
The Concepcion now, I think GPS readings suggest that it moved something like 10 feet in this last earthquake.
Yeah, I just saw that today, and wow. I was just immediately thinking of Darwin because he saw the ground move as well at first hand, and he realized that it would just take an earthquake like that every century or two over the course of many millions of years, it could produce something like the Andes. And he was right. And we've had another sad but real example of that.
And you think that these experiences, I mean, in England, you don't... Are there many earthquakes? Is it really tectonically active in London?
No. Well, the first year I lived here, there was an earthquake in North London. I think it was 5.1 or something, and some bricks fell off the house, so it can happen. But I used to live in Seattle, and
comparatively,
I experienced that big one in 2001 or 2002. I can't remember what year it was, but that scared the pants off me.
Yeah, and I would just imagine that leaving something that's a relatively stable environment, like the English countryside, where it's not a lot of change going on that's really that apparent, and suddenly traveling around the world to, you know, South America, Central America, going, seeing these just amazing places and also experiencing these earth-changing events would have had a huge impact on the way that Darwin thought as he was going through the trip.
Well, definitely. And after he came home, he started looking more carefully at home and started seeing changes like that as well. So he was able to measure the rate at which earthworms were able to create topsoil and this kind of thing, even just at his house, at Down House. So maybe the trip helped to attune him to the sorts of changes which over long periods of time can lead to major, major shifts in land masses.
So moving forward, you are in London, as your Twitter profile says, you're a reluctant Londoner.
Well, yeah, I'm not such a big city girl.
But you're working at the Natural History Museum and you work in the Department of Botany there, working mostly on DNA barcoding. Is that correct?
That's right. I've been working at the Natural History Museum since 2003. And as a geneticist by training, it's been a real learning experience for me because I've been kind of thrust into the world of museum collections and taxonomy and systematics. And so I've learned a lot, but I also feel like I've been able to contribute something perhaps unusual in that environment. So for me, it's been a really positive experience.
In addition to your work at the Natural History Museum, you're also working as the science director for the Beagle Project. Can you give us a little history of what the Beagle Project is, the history, where the idea came from, where it's going, hopefully?
Well, the idea of retracing the voyage of the Beagle is what really captivated me initially about when I heard about this project the first year I moved to London in 2002. And a person called Peter McGrath, I got in touch with him because I read about him in a newspaper article. He wanted to rebuild the Beagle, Darwin's ship. And, well, I should say, actually, you wrote Darwin's Beagle Voyage on your caption on the screen, but it was Fitzroy's.
Right.
Fitzroy was the captain, so let's not forget Fitzroy, scientist.
I was kind of making a play. I was trying to make a play on the voyage of the Dawn Treader from the the title, The Voyage of Darwin's Beagle. I didn't know if it's really, yeah.
Fair enough. I like your title. and it is a lot about Darwin, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But you know, a shout out to Fitzroy.
Okay.
Anyways, yes. So I heard about this idea to rebuild the ship. And I guess when I first came here, I had only seen maybe a few tall ships in my life. But I, being an inland girl originally from Colorado, and they have a power to captivate people. And I thought that linking this up with science and science outreach just seemed like all of the things I wanted to get to see together, to do real science and combine that with engaging an increasingly disillusioned public and children as well about the excitement of science, the sort of excitement that takes people on voyages around the world and also in intellectual voyages. So when I heard about this, I didn't hesitate to pick up the phone and call the one name that was mentioned in the article, Peter McGrath. And we struck up a conversation. I said I wanted to volunteer for the project. And the project has gone through some changes over that time. That original project actually dissolved and then was resurrected by Peter, as well as David Lort Phillips from Wales, who's Admiral John Lort Stokes's great-great-grandson. John Lort Stokes was Darwin's cabin mate on the Beagle, so he had a family connection there. Mm-hmm. They resurrected the project, and I really wanted to be involved. And they finally let me. So they haven't been able to get rid of me since. I'm really committed to seeing this vision through. I think it's absolutely captivating. Well, it's captivated me as a scientist, and I've seen the expressions on people's faces when they hear about the project, when they see a tall ship, when they learn about Darwin's adventures as a 22-year-old young man in South America and beyond.
Yeah, and I found this image of the HMS Beagle online. This is actually a model of the HMS Beagle. If you would like to know what a tall ship looks like, if you haven't ever seen one, they have very tall masts and when they set sail, there are normally several sails on each of the 2 to 3 masts that are on the tall ship. And have you actually been on a tall ship yourself?
Well, I have just recently with the Beagle Project. We went to South America in September. Even though we haven't yet succeeded in raising the funds necessary to rebuild HMS Beagle, that hasn't stopped us from trying to do activities to support our mission that is combining traditionally rigged tall ships with science education and outreach. So we went to South America and collaborated with an existing tall ship called the Tocorime, which was built in the Amazon basin. And so I got my first chance to climb rigging, and it was absolutely fantastic to hear the sort of creak of the wood under my feet and hear the sails and everything. Mm-hmm. Even though we didn't go far, I felt like we were really starting this project.
Yeah, and if people are interested in seeing what the Beagle Project is up to, the Beagle Project has a blog. It's the Beagle Project. blogspot.com, and in one of the blog postings, there's a lot of media and other things that have been put out there, and you had a couple of videos. Did you get to climb the rigging? Is that what you said?
Yeah, that last video at the bottom there is a short video taken by Kevin Zelnio, who of Deep Sea News, who came with us on the trip, and he took a picture of me climbing the rigging in my sandals. I'm sure that violates health and safety or whatnot. but it was a beautiful day, as you can see, and this was really exciting for me, even though I had to be trailed by safety guy there.
Right, to make sure you weren't falling. Were you wearing a harness also?
I was wearing a harness, and I have a bit of rock climbing experience, so it wasn't too unfamiliar to me. But you would unclip from one rung and just clip it up just to give yourself a bit of a shorter fall should you fall.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was thrilling, and I imagined, you know, Darwin climbing up there on the Beagle, much younger than I am now, but he would have had the same experience.
Yeah. Do you think he would have climbed the rigging? Do you think he would have stayed on deck or below deck? He had terrible seasickness almost the entire voyage, didn't he? I mean, would he have really gotten off of the hard plank of the deck to climb in the rigging?
He did have terrible seasickness, and unfortunately he never got rid of it, but that just makes me admire him more because he was from a wealthy family. He could have given up and taken the first packet ship home, but he didn't. He stuck with it for the whole 5 years. He thought it would be two, but it turned out to be five. And I just really admire that. But there were calm days, and there were days when, many days when the ship was sitting calmly in a harbor somewhere, in a bay somewhere, and he would have maybe gone up then. He talked about, you know, collecting dust off of the rigging. He observed all kinds of wildlife while he was out there. So he was definitely watching. He just didn't always, he wasn't always above decks. He was sometimes down there puking his guts out. Poor guy.
I know. Now, with the Beagle Project, what you're trying to do is recreate Darwin's voyage. So, the boat still has to be built, right? Is there any existing boat? Is there anything at this point?
Well, I should say that we're not the only ones to have the idea of retracing Darwin's voyage. There have been other, especially during 2009 last year, the bicentenary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species. It was really the Darwin year, especially here in the UK.
Yeah,
and so a lot of people had that idea. There were people who did, journalists who did the trips on their own to report on it by plane. They would fly from port to port. Our co-founder, Peter, would say that's cheating terribly, and I would tend to agree with him. there have been other boats that have retraced the voyage as well. The Stad Amsterdam is associated with a Dutch television series to retrace the voyage on a modern tall ship to make a TV series in the Dutch mm-hmm. language. We're not the only people to have this idea, but we are unique in the sense that we're trying to rebuild the Beagle so that she'll look the way that she looked when Darwin boarded her, with some modern amenities and safety devices added.
There's no reason why you can't make the boat just a little bit better.
Right. And also not just for 1 year, but that she would be dedicated to this purpose, not just for the original retracing Fitzroy and Darwin's voyage, but also after that for hopefully decades, taking scientists mm-hmm. and students and teachers and lucky members of the public out to sea. So we think this is a legacy project of mm-hmm. the Darwin celebrations, and not just a one-off 1 year project.
And now when you get the boat and even what you've done already in your training missions, your practice missions in Brazil, you're going to be doing a lot of science there. So what are the science projects that you're planning for the Beagle?
Well, you mentioned DNA barcoding at the mm-hmm. beginning. That's something I've been involved in a lot at the Natural History Museum, and it is the simplest way to describe it is a DNA-based recognition system for species, for biological species, mm-hmm. So that instead of having to say, look at the flower of a plant to be able to tell what species of plant it is, maybe you could just look at the DNA, especially in cases where you might just have a fragment of leaf or wood and didn't have those diagnostic characters. And this is a major international project that's been happening since 2005. And scientists around the world are building databases of DNA sequences associated with expertly named and identified specimens So the push is really on to collect more of these specimens and add them to the database. So the Beagle retracing would be participating in that project and would invite scientists aboard to do research projects, but also all of the specimens that would be collected with those research projects, whether they had a DNA element or not, would be contributed to the barcoding database as well. And there are, we hope to host a number of scientists who would be doing independent research projects, you know, peer reviewed projects that they would be doing anyways with their postdocs and graduate students, so that they could spend some time aboard the vessel, have an experience of a lifetime, perhaps reinvigorating their own careers, and also actually getting to do a piece of research. And this, the possibility of this is what fills up my email inbox every couple of weeks or so.
I'm sure there is so, I mean, the idea of sailing on a replica of the Beagle and doing science and being able, I'm sure there are so many people who would be interested in doing that. I mean, I'll just go apply for a scientific grant right now just so that I can, you know, try. I'll make up a project now.
Get in line. but seriously, I am trying to develop a portfolio of project ideas, which will help us to raise the funds necessary to build the ship by showing off the exciting science we can do. Mm-hmm. We're more likely to get the money. So if people are watching this and are scientists and want to pitch an idea for a project aboard the new Beagle, they can definitely get in touch with us through our blog or email. It's on our website. So we're definitely looking for those ideas right now already.
And you have also, I've got some video here of from the blog again of your boat down in Brazil that you were on and doing some science on that trip down to Brazil. This is not because there's no HMS Beagle replica as of yet. You are using other boats, as you said. But what's the science that you're doing in this video here? Let me pull this up.
Okay, well, this is the Tocorime, the Brazilian ship, and this is a group of people. We're doing DNA barcoding here aboard the ship down under the hull. That's Kevin Zelnio with me and Patricia Milislavich doing some DNA barcoding of Antarctic marine invertebrates and other South American invertebrates, and I'm setting up a PCR. I know it looks very glamorous, but it's pretty simple. If you know molecular biology, it's not... it's not that difficult of a thing. It's something you can actually do on a tall ship, which is why we think it's suited so well. In this part of the... Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask what was happening in the end of the... I guess there's something... There we go. So in this video, you're working with school children down in Brazil. What happened there?
So this was so exciting for me. As well, anyone who follows me on Twitter knows I'm kind of gaga about the space program.
What's your Twitter handle in case people do want to follow you?
At K.E. James, just K.E. James. So what we have here are 60 local school children from the town of Parachi, which is where we did this project. And we put them up in a live question and answer session with an astronaut aboard the International Space Station, which was flying overhead at the time that we did this project. And the timing of this whole trip to Brazil was meant to enable this to happen. So we have kids here who have learned their questions in English and are nervously waiting to ask their questions. And they ask the questions and get the answers from the real astronauts in space. You can see how excited they are, but what they aren't showing here is that the teachers and scientists and parents who were sitting, you know, one step back behind the cameras, some of them had tears in their eyes. They were so delighted about seeing the children experiencing this and getting excited themselves. And a lot of them came afterwards to me and explained what a special experience that had been for them, and that they were really inspired about discovery and space and sailing. I mean, astronaut means star sailor, so there's a real connection between space travel and voyages of discovery like what we're proposing.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that you are working with NASA on some of this, that you've got this ship that is going to go out and voyage to explore the oceans and to explore life on the planet, and you're partnering with an organization that's creating ships that should go and explore our universe. And so there's this real parallel in purpose.
I think so. I think it's really natural. It didn't always seem that way to me, I have to admit, when I first...
Like NASA, what? No.
Yeah. Well, when, I mean, I'm an Air Force brat, so I had always sort of loved planes and flying and space things. In fact, saw the space shuttle when I was a little girl when it was parked over on a return flight from Edwards Air Force Base through Colorado. Mm. So I'd always loved that, but I was absolutely gobsmacked when astronaut Mike Barrett emailed me out of the blue a few years back and said, "You probably get all kinds of crazy emails, so consider this the latest. I'm an astronaut. I'm going to be in space in 2009. I read about your project in Science Magazine."
Wow.
There was a little blurb about us in the sort of news and views section.
Yeah.
And it must have been sitting on a coffee table somewhere at Johnson Space Center. I don't know. But he saw it, and he had a biology and paleontology background and really loved evolution and the natural sciences. So he got in touch and said, "I think we should work together." And I just completely flipped out. And you know, this was so exciting. Called my mother. And
I got an email from an astronaut, Mom. Yeah.
So he was actually the one that those kids were talking to on the space station.
Very cool.
in September. And he told me that he's been... in a phone call, actually, he actually phoned me from space. This was another amazing experience that I just thought, how can this be happening to me? But
excuse me, will you accept the charges?
Yeah. Actually, the phone number on my cell phone read 000000. So I thought, well, what the heck? I'll try calling it back. It didn't work.
Right. No.
But he actually told me while he was up there that he had been assigned to the final flight of the space shuttle. So he is going to launch on September 16th this year, mm-hmm. on the last flight of the space shuttle. And I'm really going to try and be there in Florida to watch him launch.
That would be very, very cool. That would be very cool. Now, since starting, this is really neat, but since starting working with Mike Barrett and starting to work with NASA, like, what are you and NASA doing? Is there more of a partnership that's at work right now?
Well, we signed an agreement. NASA has a bureaucracy, famously. And yeah. We worked together to, Mike and I worked together to produce an agreement that both the HMS Beagle Trust and NASA could be happy with. And it's called an International Space Act Agreement. It helps to provide a structure for NASA working together with foreign organizations who aren't already in treaties with them for space travel, like the European Space Agency. They already have an agreement with, but we're a different organization, so we needed this agreement. And basically it has three parts. So there's the scientific collaborations, which will involve astronauts aboard the space station taking photographs of the new Beagle's position while the new Beagle is sampling biological specimens to correlate with those images from space. And this is a really exciting area of work right now, trying to correlate ground truthing data from the surface of the Earth with images from space, so that we can help to calibrate those images and know what we're looking at. And, you know, this whole Earth focus is something that has kind of been emerging recently in the editorial sections of science magazines and everything. So it feels really topical. And we were actually practicing this a bit in Brazil. We did some sampling, as you saw in the video. And Mike, indeed, was on the space station taking images of our position. So we were practicing what it will be like. The second aspect of the proposal of the agreement is to work together also on public outreach and public engagement relating to our science activities together. And then the third element is education. And you saw the children speaking with the astronaut. That's a good example of the sort of educational outreach that we might be able to do. And though Mike is not aboard the space station anymore, He has committed to kind of recruiting the astronauts who come after him to help this project go into the future. So it will be different astronauts in the future. Maybe Mike will get to go back there again someday. But, you know, we hope there will be, again, a long-term partnership here for science, education, and outreach.
It seems like a really, really neat partnership. I mean, it just seems like there could be so much to grow out of it. And it's in so many kids to inspire. And I mean, that's the huge, I think the huge part of it is being able to take, you know, this partnership and inspire young minds to maybe go into science, maybe go into engineering, or, you know, just go into some aspect of space or travel, or, you know, there's so many neat things.
Yeah. One of my favorite aspects of it actually is the idea that we could perhaps transfer enthusiasm between biology and space science by having this project together. Yeah. You know, it's famously said that we went to go land on the moon, but we discovered the Earth, because the images of the Earth from outer space just blew everybody away and made us realize how fragile and unique our planet is. Really is. And so there's always been that tie between the Earth and the space program, and especially at least in the near future, the space station and other satellites that are being launched, including recently a new weather and climate satellite, are increasingly focused on problems like climate change and global environmental change. So I think this is a really natural combination, and I hope we'll be able to, you know, take people who are inspired by the space program and create some pathways through to biology and conservation and back the other way as well.
Yeah. And the DNA barcoding program you're working on, that's just one aspect of how to get people interested and involved. That's one aspect of the science that can come out of it. And you, In your research personally at the Natural History Museum, are you using any aspect of the genetic analysis, DNA barcoding, in your research on you're working with a mockingbird project, right?
Right. So I should explain that for the last couple of years, my role at the museum has been divided into two parts. Mm-hmm. The first is research DNA barcoding. Developing a DNA barcoding system for plants. I'm based in the botany department at the museum.
Yeah, and you recently published a very important paper in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
I wasn't the first author on that, so don't anyone get the wrong idea, but thank you.
But you
were involved. There were a lot of authors, and I was one of them, so I'm very proud, yes. There was a paper announcing the culmination of 4 years' hard work by many botanical systematists and molecular biologists, including myself, around the world, to work towards a solution to what we saw as a problem with expanding the idea of DNA barcoding from animals to plants. Yeah. The gene that was selected for identifying animals based on DNA was the mitochondrial gene cytochrome oxidase 1. And that gene just isn't variable enough in plants to do the same for plants. So we were on this big hunt for the correct gene or genes to use in the same capacity for plants. And we made the announcement with that paper and at the meeting in Mexico City for DNA barcoding that was held in November. So definitely that was a lot of work for many people, not just me, definitely not just me. And also during that time, though, I was working at the museum as the coordinator for Darwin-related science projects. We had a whole campaign of projects, both public and behind-the-scenes projects relating to the Darwin bicentenary. And being as enthusiastic about Darwin as I am, I jumped at the opportunity to work on some of these projects. So, for example, I worked with a group of curators and researchers. I helped to coordinate a survey of the specimens that we hold at the museum that were collected by Darwin. It might seem strange that we don't know that, we don't have that information, but we have 70 million specimens. And what that means is any one curator cannot possibly know really every specimen that they take care of. So we made a survey, hopefully to lead to a proposal to conserve these specimens and make them all available online. So that was one project. And another one was this one you mentioned about the mockingbirds. And I don't know if you can see over my head right there.
A little mockingbird plate on the wall. I can see it back there.
So that is, I really feel personally invested in this project, which is why I bought that. I actually bought it in an auction of art made by Lala Ward, Richard Dawkins' wife, as a conservation fundraiser for the Galapagos. They were selling these various items, or auctioning these various items to raise funds for conservation there, and they made one of the Floriana mockingbird. So of course I had to jump in there and, you know, sell a kidney.
I want one. I need to have it.
Which led kind of weirdly and excitingly to Richard Dawkins actually phoning me up at work, which was not something I expected, and I was sort of. But yeah,
jaw dropping. That's you get some neat phone calls and emails. That's very cool,
especially from you.
Oh shucks.
Yeah, but the Mockingbird project was really exciting. Basically, you're showing a link to this video here now, which is on the Natural History Museum website on the Species of the Day page for the Floriana Mockingbird. Basically, there are researchers who at the University of Zurich who have been working on understanding the genetics and the population structures of the mockingbirds in Galapagos. Now, it's important to say that mockingbirds, not finches, were kind of Darwin's muse in the Galapagos. And here, Joe Cooper, a curator at Tring in our bird department, is showing Darwin's famous finches. And what she's saying in the video, if you watch it, is that actually it wasn't the finches so much as the mockingbirds that inspired him. And the mockingbirds that he first encountered in Galapagos, one of the populations, one of the species, the Floriana mockingbird, is now very much endangered. There it is. It's so sweet, pecking on the flower. They're kind of
so
fuzzy.
And it looks almost like a little baby bird with down.
I know. They're kind of disheveled. And they're very tame. They'll hop up and try and untie your shoelaces. Not that I've been there in person, but I want to go one day. But the mockingbirds on Floriana went extinct on Floriana before the end of the 19th century and only survived on two tiny satellite islets nearby Floriana. So it's one of the rarest birds, if not the rarest bird in the world.
Wow.
And here's actually a diagram in the video showing Floriana and the islets. And so there's a project right now that these University of Zurich researchers, Lucas Keller and Paquita Hook, are working on to help underpin a reintroduction project of the Floriana mockingbird back onto Floriana by doing some groundwork, some genetics-based groundwork. So what I did as a part of the Darwin celebrations was to help to coordinate and do some of the molecular biology for a project to get the specimens that Darwin and Fitzroy actually collected when they were there on the Beagle, which are two of maybe four or five specimens in the world that were collected on Floriana before they went extinct there, to get those included in the genetic study. And it's harder than it sounds because these are precious, precious specimens, and you really have to do your homework and your background work to make sure that you're not taking a sample from such a precious specimen without good reason and without knowing it's pretty much going to work. So this this video right here is showing me in the lab actually doing the DNA extraction on these Darwin and Fitzroy mockingbirds. You can tell I'm a little bit nervous here because I'm actually being filmed.
On camera, yeah.
And it wasn't a dummy specimen. Those were actually the ones. So I was a little bit nervous and I made some bubbles with my pet tip and I was a little bit nervous about that. But it was fantastic. I had those samples sitting on my desk at work for a while and I kept looking at them. My gosh, those were on the Beagle. You know, I just couldn't believe it.
That's got to be an amazing feeling to say, to know that you're working with 200-year-old samples, almost, or I guess 150-year-old samples, that Darwin collected himself, that he didn't know he was collecting something of this kind of importance, because he hadn't even formulated his own ideas about how change takes place.
And he didn't know anything about DNA, of course.
Yeah.
And the ideas about conservation were totally different then, though he did write a bit about the fears he had about certain habitats being destroyed by man. So that wasn't completely foreign to him, yeah. But certainly he, you know, that just wasn't part of the ethic then. And he didn't know about anything about DNA, and yet the samples he collected yielded DNA to us 170 years later and are helping us to make recommendations about the conservation of this. And I think this beautifully illustrates the importance of these historical specimens held in places like natural history museums around the world, that you can never really predict what you're going to need them for. And it's really important to save them for posterity.
And on that note, I need to take a quick word for our sponsor. So if you'll just wait for one quick moment. Dr. Kiki Science Hour would like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring this episode. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks and audio content online that you can download. They have more than 60,000 titles. I'm pretty sure that as every day goes by, they have more and more titles. They're probably getting up over 100,000 titles, because it's not just books, it's magazines, newspapers, podcasts, all sorts of audio content that with a membership with Audible.com, you are able to download that content. And Audible.com is offering a free audiobook download to listeners of the Science Hour if you would like to try it out. And you can use their special code. It's a web address, www.audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, K-I-K-I. And you can download any audiobook of your choice. And in honor of our guest on the show today, Dr. James, I'm going to suggest a British writer, Ben Goldacre. He is a journalist, an author, a skeptic, a critical thinker, and he wrote a book called Bad Science. Bad Science is it's a great read. He critically looks at a lot of stories that have made it into the public sphere dealing with just health, medicine, science, and he breaks them down just point by point and goes through the arguments in a very rational way. And it's written very well. And so listening to it would probably be a fairly entertaining read. He can be a very funny guy. So I suggest Bad Science by Ben Goldacre for the suggested book for Audible.com's Pick of the Week for the Science Hour. So to download that audiobook, where do you want to go? You want to go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And I'd like to thank audible.com for their sponsorship of the Science Hour. Karen, I'd love to talk a little bit about your own personal history as we get towards the end of the show here. You have, you're a geneticist. You are a Darwin fanatic. Maybe we won't. We talked earlier. Maybe we won't call it. We won't call you a historian per se. But
no.
You enjoy Darwin.
I'm not a historian.
and you have an upbringing that would seem to be at odds with where you are right now. And so I'd love to find out how you got to where you are and how you got interested in evolution and Darwin.
Well, I guess like Darwin suggested, a number of small changes over a long period of time can lead to an enormous change. And so it was right. For me. I grew up in a evangelical Christian community and household and church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And creationism was all part and parcel with that. And, you know, when you're young, you generally believe what your parents believe or what people tell you or what your community or social group believes. And I was no exception to that. And then as I got a bit older, I started on a sort of a long journey of introspection and critical thinking and I went through a really hard period where I was trying to reconcile the science I was learning at college at Colorado State University with my sort of traditional upbringing and the beliefs associated with that upbringing. And I went through this whole period trying to reconcile it. And I actually want to say this is why I think so many people are attracted to intelligent design. If you're trying to hold on to both science and your fundamentalist belief system, the least amount of pain is caused by grasping on to something like intelligent design, which allows you to have your cake and eat it too. So I went through a period where I thought that might work out. I even wrote an essay in college about trying to reconcile what I was learning about evolution with what the creation events were in Genesis. And it's strange to read that now. But
look back on it and think about what was my mindset and what was I thinking then. Yeah.
But basically, over time, I basically became fully separated or released from those previous dogmas, and now I would consider myself an atheist, and I am, as you said, I'm a Darwin groupie. I don't like to say Darwin fanatic. Fanatic
makes it sounds a little crazy, right?
Just. Yeah. He was a great guy. He was human and flawed like everybody else, but he did some astonishing things and he really changed the way we think about ourselves. So I think he's a great guy and I like to promote him for that reason. I do think we have a tendency to, some people have a tendency to use words of reverence around scientific heroes. And I think we should just all be a bit more careful about that because that just feeds into the hands of creationists who would like to use that against us. So I've given a lot of thought to how to talk about evolution and reason with people who I like to think that I can maybe sympathize with a bit more because I used to be one of them.
Yeah. And do you think, is there any way to bring the religious beliefs together with the scientific beliefs? I mean, for you, it's completely, you've completely split the two.
Yeah. I mean, some people would like to say that science will naturally ultimately drive you away from religion. Dawkins is one of these.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I would go quite that far. You can, as I heard Eugenie Scott say once, you can build a belief system based on science, but you don't have to. So it's not necessarily a prerequisite for your belief system, that you can still hold a supernatural belief system. And I know it sounds strange, but to maybe to your listeners, and viewers, but I know a lot of people who do this, and it makes them comfortable and yet they don't deny anything about evolution. They've just, they've come to a concept of their religion that is compatible with it. And I think those people tend to be the silent ones who don't talk much in the debate, but they're out there. And there's a book called Coming to Peace with Science, written by Daryl Falk from an evangelical Christian perspective, that I think seems to have an effect on you know, kind of hardcore creationists who might read it. Without naming names, I think that book, in my experience, has been something that can change people's minds. It's not, if you're trying to convert someone to atheism, this is not the book for you. This is something for evangelical Christians who want to know from someone that they trust is sort of on their side, what the evidence is and how that can sort of be used not to degrade their religious beliefs, but actually to uplift them. So I think he seems to strike a tone for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I think that one of the words that you used there is something that I wish would go away. It's having a side that, you know, you have to have somebody on your side, or you can't talk to the person from the other side and it puts a divide. There is a mental divide there, definitely.
And one of my big bugbears is the assumption on a lot of, threads of certain blogs that people like me would have been considered lost causes. So when I was 16, 17, if you had encountered me and you were a hardcore evolutionist and fought against the creationists, you might have thought that I was a lost cause. I was someone to argue with. I was someone to disrespect. And look what happened. So I just want, my point, I guess, is that there's hope for everyone and not to write people off and to be respectful.
Yeah, respectful communication can go a really, really long way.
And that doesn't mean necessarily caving in or accommodating, but the name calling and everything, that has to stop.
Yeah. No name calling. I try and minimize the name calling. Every once in a while, I rant a little bit. And
oh, not you, Kiki. Happens, I just mean other.
Generally. No, I know. You're like, Kiki. Yeah. Yes. No.
I mean, I've even had my moments where I've boiled over and thought, that is just stupid. But, you know, I think in general, there is a middle ground of people who can be reasoned with, and I think we shouldn't give up on them.
Yeah, absolutely not. And with the Beagle Project, with the outreach work that you're doing, and with the research, just everything that you're working on, it seems like you're working in that direction of just talking with people, communicating, reasoning, and maybe having an impact that way.
I think that's right. I see the Beagle Project as a really positive way to enter this promoting science in modern society sort of discussion. Why not promote science for all of the great things that it does and can do for us, and the way it can transform our lives, and the way it can help us understand the world, and the awesome ways that it opens up windows on our universe, not just our planet. Mm-hmm. And that's inspiring and exciting and adventurous. And so why not focus on that instead of focusing on, as you said, taking sides and getting in a debate? I just don't see that working very well. It doesn't mean that I don't debate. It doesn't mean that I don't get in little heated discussions with people. But
right.
I think that a lot of energy and money is spent on those kinds of debates. And it's not just because I'm fundraising for this project, which I am. But, I think that having a positive focus and focusing especially on younger people about the excitement and adventure, the physical adventure of going into space or going around the world of science, and how that can unlock our imaginations, and also the intellectual adventure of doing science, the career of a scientist, the possibilities that might lie there for people. So I think all of that is a much more positive focus than the negativity that sometimes enters into discussions about science.
Yeah. And if people are interested on helping to the Beagle Project and helping with your fundraising, how can they get involved? How far do you have any information on how far you are from your goals? I mean,
well, if you add up sort of in-kind donations and cash donations, we're a couple hundred thousand pounds in there. But we need 5 million pounds to rebuild this vessel.
Wow.
And yeah, although it sounds like a lot, but dollar's getting stronger than the pound now. And the, it's a lot smaller than some other projects of a similar nature that are out there. So I don't think it's undoable, that it's not doable at all. I mean, look at the atheist bus ad. They raised £182,000 in, I think, a few months to put atheist ads on London buses. So if we can do that, surely we can raise funds for the new Beagle. But yeah, we can accept donations right now on our website, thebeagleproject.com. And we're also looking for networking and partnership opportunities that can help us get to the right people who would be interested in sharing our mission and our vision with us.
And here is the website for thebeagleproject.com. It's the home to the adventure. And there's information on the science, on all the people who are involved.
And there's the PayPal buttons down there.
You can pay in US dollars or in the British pound.
That's right.
Yeah. That's neat. Is there any, I didn't notice on here as I was looking around, is there anywhere that there's like an update on the progress of your fundraising? Is there any kind of like, if you donate, you can figure out how well it's going?
We're still kind of working on integrating something like that into our website. We're gearing up, hopefully, for kind of a whole project reboot this year. And I can't give any specific dates or anything yet, but various things are converging, and we're probably going to be kind of relaunching or re-inaugurating the project sometime this year, in which case we would have a new website with one of those little, temperature bars that shows our fundraising progress so far and everything. But the best place for now for updates is actually the blog, the Beagle Project blog, because we post there pretty regularly. We went through kind of a cold spell in January. Maybe it was the cold weather. I don't know. we've been writing this blog for several years now, and we're much more likely to post information on there about the progress, or if we have any major news or major fundraising coups or anything like that, they would go on there first. But do watch this space and watch the Beagle Project website for changes in the future and for a rebooting of the project.
That sounds great. And for people to keep an eye on you and to find out if they're interested in hearing more about what's happening in your life and what you're doing, what's the website that
I'm going to bed, first of all.
What's a website where they can find you? What are the best places that they can keep tabs if they're interested?
The best place is Twitter. I've become kind of a Twitter convert, and it just suits my sort of rapid fire brain cells or something better than blogging a little bit, I think. But, I do still post blog posts, just maybe not at the frequency I used to. So Twitter's the best. And I also have a kind of a personal professional website, kejames.com, which links to all of my various projects and blogs and Twitter accounts and everything else that's going on, and has links to things like my Natural History Museum CV page and the blogs that I also write a blog called Data Not Shown, which I'm in the process of actually shifting over to the museum's website. So there will be some changes there coming up soon. But that's a space where I keep all of my various accounts live.
Now, there was another site, and I'm not something linked to one of your pages, and I'm looking for it. You have this photo stream that are pictures you've taken with your iPhone of specimens.
Oh, yeah.
Here, the Saved by Science. Is that the...
Yeah.
Is this it?
I've gone through several bursts on this, and I feel maybe another one coming on, but I was really inspired by a photo story that was linked to a Carl Zimmer piece in... I'm going to get this wrong. Was it National Geographic? Carl, if you're watching, I'm sorry. I only wish Carl was watching. But so there was a photo story called Saved by Science, and a professional photographer and Carl Zimmer went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York and wrote a story and took some amazing photos of the dusty corners and the old specimens that were found there. Mm-hmm. And I found it just really exciting and kind of provocative too. So I thought, I see things every day in the Natural History Museum in London. I see the places where they hid specimens during the Blitz, and I see things that other people don't get to see. So I got the idea that I could do something similar in my own kind of amateurish way. And I've been taking pictures of just things that strike me as a little odd at the Natural History Museum behind the scenes that I think people might find interesting. So I think I've taken 8 or 9 so far, but I do hope to keep it up. And I post those on Twitter, and then I also aggregate them on that. There's one. Boxed material, Kungu cakes, tabanid mud towers, SEM stubs, flea printing blocks, training specimens, and welcome collection part,
etc.
Seems
rather random.
Yeah, things like that. I find all the time that people say, wow, you work at the museum. I've always wondered what it's like there. So I thought there might be an audience for something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there definitely could be. Unfortunately, I'm not able to bring up the pictures on your webpage. I'm going through.
I think it's on the Saved by Science tab of kejames.com.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not there. The photos themselves are not opening. Oh wait,
oh, really?
I found one. There were a couple of.
Oh yeah, that's the new building at the Natural History Museum, the Cocoon. It's an 8-story cocoon structure to house in a new part of the building called the Darwin Center, to house both a public exhibition of and put our science on display, but also to house tens of millions of entomological and botanical specimens. So, and the lab I work in is on the 6th floor of that glass structure just above the cocoon.
Wow. Way up there. Yeah, unfortunately, some of the really cool, so titled,
that's
What
really,
Doesn't
well,
Every Library
for,
Have a Porcupine? I really want to see that picture now.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this to my attention. I'm slightly embarrassed.
Yeah,
but it's not there.
I was just looking at them earlier today and last night. So
I don't know what it is. Do twit pics expire? Does anybody know?
I don't think so. Yeah. So I had a request from somebody to bring up your Twitter page again. So I'm going to bring up your Twitter page. So anyone who's interested, the Saved by Science photos do get tweeted through K.E. James on Twitter if you're interested in seeing the behind the scenes.
And each time I tweet one, I provide a link to the archive that's on my kejames.com site.
Yeah.
And I'll, as soon as we're done here and I get some sleep,
yes,
I will be rushing to my website to make sure those are actually there.
Make sure they're actually up there. I think maybe it could just be an error on my end as well. So hopefully they are there for people.
I hate to say this, but I hope so.
I know. I hope it's your fault. I hope it's you. So I'm on that note, I will let you go get some sleep. I appreciate this late night Skype call. I appreciate the time that you've taken to talk with us about the Beagle Project, about the Florianus mockingbirds, about DNA barcoding and NASA and all the exciting projects. You're into some very, very cool stuff. And so thanks for sharing.
Thanks. I think so too. And it's been a real pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, thank you. And if anybody is interested in finding out more about Dr. James, you can find her website, which is kejames.com, and on Twitter, K.E. James. And I believe that is about it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Another hour is in the can. Next week, we will be talking about vaccines with Dr. Gregory Poland from the Mayo Clinic. He is an expert on the development, the research going into vaccines, and hopefully he'll have some straightforward answers on how vaccines are made, how they are produced, how they end up getting used and applied in our United States and other countries on the planet. And if you have any questions about vaccines, I ask you to send me an email at kiki@twit.tv or drkiki@twit.tv, and we'll see if we can answer those questions, see if Dr. Poland will answer them. If you want to do a video question, you can use Vidly, vid.ly. You can record a video of yourself asking a question, and I will hopefully be able to play it on next week's show and then get Dr. Poland to answer your question. Vid.ly, again, all it takes is a webcam in your computer, and you just hit record and it records it. And then when you're done, you hit stop and then you tweet it. So you have to have a Twitter account as well to be able to get it out. When you tweet it, use the hashtag DKSH. That's #DKSH. And then I will be able to search for DKSH in the Twitterverse and find you. And I will then be able to use you on my show. I love your feedback also. So if you don't have any questions for next week, but you have commentary, other suggestions for guests, let me know. Again, drkiki@twit.tv. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm at drkiki, D-R-K-I-K-I. And I'm also at drkiki.tv online if you'd like to go find my blog. So there. That's it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour, another show in the can. I hope you'll join me again next week.